The Tom Woods Show, episode 918.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, everybody always thinks the current U.S. president must be the worst, but man, is there competition for that title. Check out our free course on the presidents and their crimes against liberty at freehistorycourse.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. A couple weeks ago, I read an article by Andrew Bacevich, who's retired from Boston University, who's a scholar of international relations and war, and he's generally non-interventionist. I interviewed him back when I used to guest host the Peter Schiff Show. Well, anyway, he's got this interesting article up on 24 questions that are ignored by the Washington elite and the media. And these are not crazy off-the-wall questions that only oddballs would want to ask. These are the sorts of questions anybody should presumably want the answers to. And yet, not only do we not get the answers, we don't even get the questions. And I thought it might be useful to go over some or all of them, not so much so that I can answer them, because they're really meant to be rhetorical questions, really, but just to indicate how impoverished the discussion of these topics really is. So, for example, he says that since the first one involves accomplishing the mission, so the U.S., since the immediate aftermath of World War II, has been committed to defending key allies in Europe and East Asia. And then these security guarantees were extended to the Middle East as well. So the question is, when and under what circumstances can Americans expect that maybe some of these countries might take responsibility for managing their own affairs? Is this just going to go on indefinitely? Second question, American military supremacy. We all know the U.S. military is funded very, very heavily. You combine all the military spending of the rest of the world and you get pretty much the U.S. military budget. So then Bacevich wants to know, why doesn't this great military ever win anything? Or why is it that if we look in recent decades at what the stated wartime objectives of the regime are, why has the military been unable to meet those objectives? Why is it that we've been fighting the war on terror for 15 years, and yet we can't point to one real success anywhere? That's a legitimate question. No answer. But not only no answer, no question. Right? The major newspapers just carry on as if it's normal that we should be pursuing a strategy that yields nothing. It's like they would consider it rude even to want an answer to that question. Then, America's empire of bases. So we all know there are American military bases all over the world in all kinds of countries. You wouldn't even think there would be bases there. And everybody justifies this. Barack Obama justified this. The, you know, of course, the neocons and the people who've been brainwashed by right-wing radio think Barack Obama was an isolationist, if you can believe that. I just heard that repeated the other day. Some isolationist, he defends having troops in 135 countries, and he says it would be isolationist to reverse that policy. So they all basically have the same policy on garrisoning the planet. So the question here is it really true that this policy gives us peace and stability, when it quite clearly seems to give the opposite, with people in numerous countries feeling like they're being occupied by American troops? So why would you think that this policy would have any other effect? Okay, well, just ask yourself, when was the last time a reporter asked that question? Then he has a thing about supporting the troops. Now, this one is actually hard for me to summarize, because I think this actually is a whole episode in and of itself, that we have these bountiful yet superficial expressions of regard for the troops. And he talks about, he says, the present-day military system, there's a growing gap between those who serve and those who applaud from the sidelines. Our system is neither democratic nor effective. Why has discussion and debate about its deficiencies not found a place among the nation's political priorities? Well, then, number five, we get to prerogatives of the commander-in-chief. Now, we all know there has been a debate about, can the president, well, actually, there hasn't been a debate, has there? There's been a debate among scholars, but in the public eye, there hasn't been a debate about whether the president can send troops anywhere he wants, whenever he wants. And I've argued about that. I've got a whole essay on that. I've got a thing at libertyclassroom.com/warpowers. I'm pretty sure is where you can find the detailed answer to that whole question. But basically, the political class takes for granted that the president can do this. So what Bacevich wants to know is, are there any military actions that the president may not order on his own authority? You know, or where you wouldn't find a defender of the president somewhere? Or where everybody would be united in saying he really can't do that? Well, what would that be? And since we've begun to defer more and more to the president when it comes to the use of military force, has this yielded us a more prudent foreign policy, a more successful foreign policy? Then how about assassinations? Well, the U.S. government, basically up until 9/11, presidents had more or less said they were not going to be in the assassination business. But after 9/11, that changed very considerably. But again, the Bacevich question is, have U.S. interests, I hate using that term, I don't ever use that term, have they been advanced by an assassination policy? Are there any costs of such a policy? And if so, how might we measure them? Again, crickets, right? Not raised. Well, then number seven is, what's the strategy? So we've got this global war on global war on strategy, global war on terrorism. Well, what is the strategy for defeating violent jihadism? So what is the sequence of steps that the U.S. government plans to follow that it expects at the end has some prospect of succeeding? If it doesn't have a series of steps, why doesn't it? And if, in fact, what appears to be the case, namely that there really is no strategy, why is that not a topic of discussion really by anyone? Then Afghanistan, number eight. The campaign formerly known as Operation Enduring Freedom. This is now the longest conflict in U.S. history. It has lasted longer than the Civil War, World War I, and World War II combined. So what is the plan for concluding this conflict? When might we expect it to be concluded? And what will that conclusion look like? Again, pretty much nothing, right? Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Then what about the whole presumption that oil means we've really got to be involved in the Persian Gulf? Persian Gulf oil is something our lives depend on. But if that was ever the case, it certainly is not the case now. It turns out that the reserves of oil that we have in the U.S. are much, much greater than we believed even a relatively short time ago. And yet, it's just taken for granted that access to Persian Gulf oil is essential to American security. Why is that believed? Now, I think that the part of the answer may be, but they don't want to say it, is that we don't need the Persian Gulf oil for our own consumption, but maybe we want to control that oil to keep it out of the hands of potential rivals. I mean, that's certainly a live possibility. Then he says, hyping terrorism. He says, each year, terrorist attacks kill far fewer Americans than a lot of other things, like oddball things, like lightning strikes, for example. And yet, when we allocate government resources, preventing terrorist attacks gets way more resources than, say, auto accidents or drug overdoses or whatever. And he wants to know why that is. And then, what about number 11? There appears to be a distinction between deaths that matter and deaths that don't. So we have terrorist attacks that kill a handful of Europeans, and they get a lot of American attention and sympathy. But there are terrorist attacks that kill far larger numbers of Arabs. So you get, for example, if something happens in France or Belgium, you get these outpourings of sympathy from Americans. But when Egyptians die or Iraqis die, well, people just shrug. And Bacevich wants to know what the difference is. Why would there be this difference in response? Then number 12, what possible purpose or pretense is served by trying to pretend that Israel does not have nuclear weapons when pretty much everybody knows they do? What goal is being achieved by keeping that quiet? Or then number 13, peace in the Holy Land. Well, you hear the U.S. even saying that a two-state solution is ultimately what they want to move toward. So the Palestinians have a state, Israel has a state, and they live in peace side by side. Now, whether that's plausible or not is another question, but to keep raising it, Basevich says, seems to be raising expectations that are unrealistic. He says, because the Israeli settlers, of course, have continued to expand their presence in the occupied territories year after year. And as they do that, of course, it becomes less and less plausible that you could have a viable Palestinian state. So why are we still talking as if that's a live option when the prospect of it appears to grow dimmer every year? Then number 14, merchandising death. He says, when it comes to arms sales, the U.S. ranks number one by a comfortable margin. And leading recipients of those arms include, of course, Saudi Arabia and Israel. Now, the Saudis, that have a per capita GDP of $20,000, purchase a lot of weapons from the U.S. every year. But Israel, with a per capita GDP of $38,000, gets the weapons courtesy of the American taxpayer. So the question is, if the Saudis have to pay, why shouldn't the Israelis? They certainly can afford it. Of course, now, you know you're not allowed to ask that question, but why the heck not? It's ridiculous and anti-intellectual to say that you can't. Number 15, our friends the Saudis, part one. 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers were Saudis. What, if anything, does this mean? Number 16, our friends the Saudis, part two. If Saudi Arabia and Iran are engaged in a competition to see which one will dominate in the Persian Gulf, why should the U.S. take the Saudi side? What aspect of Saudi Arabian society is more in line with American values than in the Iranian case? Number 17, our friends the Pakistanis. So Pakistan is a nuclear weapons proliferator. It supports the Taliban. It provided sanctuary to Osama bin Laden, and yet the U.S. government treats Pakistan as if it were an ally. Why does it do this? In what way do the values of the U.S. and Pakistan coincide? Or in what way do our interests align with one another? If they don't, why don't we just say this? Number 18, freeloading Europeans. Why can't Europe defend itself? It has a population and economy that are larger than Russia's by a considerable amount. But why is it that Americans are the ones who seem to be caring more about the fate of Eastern Europe than Western Europe does? Why are we getting involved in matters involving Poland and the Baltic states? Why aren't these European issues? Then number 19, what is the rationale for the special relationship, so-called, between the United States and the United Kingdom? This relationship dates back to the days of Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. Why should our relationship with Great Britain be any more special than our relationship with a rising power like India? Basevich wants to know. Why does a republic now approaching the 241st anniversary of its independence still need a, quote, mother country? Well, that one I'm not so offended by. But anyway, it's one of his questions. Then he says, number 20, he's talking about nuclear disarmament. He says, on the one hand, we hear American presidents talking about their hope for a nuclear-free world someday. But look at the U.S.'s actions as opposed to its words. It has nuclear strike forces on full alert. It's embarked on a costly and comprehensive trillion-dollar modernization of its nuclear arsenal, and then even refuses to adopt a no-first-use posture when it comes to nuclear war. He says, we all know the U.S. would not surrender its nukes until every other country had done so first, so what is the point of all the talk about this? And then he also says, what does American nuclear hypocrisy how does American nuclear hypocrisy affect the prospects for global nuclear disarmament, or even simply the non-proliferation of such weaponry? Then, double standards, part one. On the one hand, in America, experts and everybody, you know, politicians, they all think that the U.S. should have a global sphere of influence, that U.S. forces can be deployed all over the place, but a place like China or Russia or Iran, well, spheres of influence are obsolete. Those countries should just stay in their own countries. And it's a provocation if they go beyond their own borders. But then the question, of course, becomes, well, then why don't those rules apply to the United States? Why does the double standard exist? Then number 22, double standards part two. You hear from Washington, D.C., a lot of talk about their support for international law. But obviously, they disregard it when it gets in the way of things that they want to do, whether it's starting wars or compromising the sovereignty of other countries or authorizing agents of the U.S. to kidnap or imprison or torture or kill. So why should all other countries in the world observe international law to the letter if the U.S. government does so only when it's convenient? Then double standards part three, the U.S. condemns the indiscriminate killing of civilians in wartime. And yet, over the past 75 years, what has the U.S. government done? It has done this regularly and on a massive scale. And Basevich just comes right out and says this, by what logic, since the 1940s, has the killing of Germans, Japanese, Koreans, Vietnamese, Laotians, Cambodians, Afghans, and others by U.S. air power been any less reprehensible than the Syrian government's use of barrel bombs to kill Syrians today? When we see civilian deaths today at the hands of the U.S. government, we're told, well, this is an accident, and you got to take our word for that. But yet, anytime anything happens in another country, Syria included, it's assumed to be intentional malice. Well, again, why the double standard? There are a lot of reasons that these things could happen. Sometimes it is deliberate. Sometimes it's incompetence. Sometimes it's the fog of war, whatever. But why is one side always given the benefit of the doubt and the other side never given the benefit of the doubt? And then finally, number 24, moral obligations. He says, you know, we hear a lot from the chattering classes about the need for the U.S. to do something when something bad happens. But he says, well, on the other hand, if we have a moral obligation to help people, say, in Syria, don't we also have a moral obligation to help people in Iraq, whose country our government basically destroyed? Shouldn't the pecking order be in reverse, actually? Shouldn't it be the places that have waited the longest for justice? Shouldn't they have their grievances addressed first? So, you know, Iraq had tremendous damage done to its country back in 2003. That's 14 years ago. I mean, maybe we need to start there. So anyway, I recommend that you read this article. Take a look at these questions. He's got some interesting hyperlinks within a number of the questions, backing up what he's saying and giving further food for thought about it. Of course, you already know without my even telling you that it will be linked at tomwoods.com/918. So anyway, just a short overview of this thing, just to get you thinking, right? I mean, this could lead to conversations going on for hours, but I think some of these questions are more compelling than others, but there are 24 of them, and I think it's correct that they're not really talked about, and yet you would think these really should be talked about, and they're not by anybody, and that's weird. So we'll talk about them. That's what we're here for. So check that out at tomwoods.com/918, and I will see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.